The voice that had addressed them earlier spoke again.
We can keep this up all day, Outlanders, or until I weary of the game and dump both of you into the workings, where you'll be mulched up like so much tree bark. What's it to be?
What do you want us to do?
Take off that blaster and throw it over here, just to show me your good sense.
Over where?
Kane was completely disoriented as to the direction of the voice. A dimly seen man shape suddenly materialized at the rim of the mirrored floor.
Over here.
Kane struggled to unbuckle the straps and tabs of the Sin Eater's power holster. The rising and falling motion awoke nausea in his stomach. He wrenched the holster off his forearm and hurled it in a looping overhand. He heard it land with a thump rather than a clatter, so he knew he had cleared the glassine surface of the mirror.
Much obliged.
Almost immediately, the giant mirror stopped its tilting, and with a prolonged pneumatic whoosh, the rotation ceased. Bridget and Kane immediately climbed to their feet. She had managed to retain the harp tucked securely under an arm. The figure at the far edge of the floor approached them, walking with a steady, swift, and almost dancer-esque grace. Both people had seen similar gaits before. Behind the figure, lurking in the shadows, other shapes shifted restlessly. As the figure drew closer, his features grew more distinct, and they saw it was a man. Kane's glare of rage turned into a wide-eyed stare of astonishment. The man was tall, about Kane's height, but he was so exceptionally lean he appeared taller. Absently, Kane noted that his torso seemed strangely elongated, but perfectly in proportion with his slender arms and legs. His limbs were encased in a black, skin-tight covering like the shadow suits Kane and Bridget wore beneath their EVAs. An assortment of brightly colored cloth hung from his almost skeletal frame, giving him a scarecrow-like aspect. A long, scarlet scrap was wound around his long neck and tossed carelessly over a shoulder like a scarf, the frayed end dragging on the floor. A yellow rag around his hips served as either a sash or a belt, and another length of bright green fabric was knotted around his left thigh for no apparent purpose unless it was supposed to be decorative. The man's face was long and bony, his chin a jutting V under the smaller V of his pursed lips. His long, narrow nose looked delicate with tiny nostrils. His eyes were abnormally large, backslanted, but without the epicanthic folds of the Asian. Kane couldn't tell their color, only that they were dark, depth on depth of darkness, but a magnetic fire seemed to burn within them. His smooth complexion held the blue-white hue of skim milk, marred by a curve of scar tissue along his right cheek. The man's unnaturally long fingers bore many sigils and talismanic rings. One was a loop of iron embossed with a cup and spiral glyph. Another glittered with a hexagonal red stone. Each ring was fashioned from a different substance: crystal, metal, gems, and even what looked like polished lacquered wood. A mane of iron-gray hair grew down from a point on his forehead and high, flat temples. It was brushed back behind his ears to fall in loose, artless tumbles about his shoulders. Kane looked at his ears, and a length of slimy rope seemed to knot in his belly. The man's ears were positioned very low on his jawline, and though they lay close to the sides of his head and weren't large, he saw how they tapered to upswept points. Now he knew how the man had overheard his and Bridget's whispered exchange, and he also knew his theory was correct. But being proved right was a cold comfort under the circumstances.
Ah, you found my harp. I wondered where I'd misplaced it.
To Ahad Danann.
At her words, the man jerked to a sudden halt as if shocked. He cocked his head at her curiously. He uttered the peculiar melodious yet sobbing laugh and made an abrupt, intricate gesture with his left hand near his heart.
I bid thee felicitations and grant thee respect, other brothers. My name is McCann, but you can call me Mac.
Lakesh didn't enjoy acting as a tour guide. It evoked too many uncomfortable and embarrassing memories of his years laboring for the totality concept, when he was obliged to squire bureaucrats, high-ranking military officers, and members of oversight committees around his facilities, both in Dulce, New Mexico, and back when the Cerberus installation was known as Redoubt Bravo. Lakesh would strain to be charming and funny and diplomatic as he explained his work in the most basic layman's terms. But half the time, his audience either didn't understand or didn't care to make even the most perfunctory effort to comprehend the methodology. The military representatives were only interested in the military applications of the Cerberus Mattrans network, and the oversight committee members cared only how much money was being spent to develop machines that seemed inspired by old science fiction movies. The bean counters were the hardest to impress, inasmuch as Project Cerberus and all of the totality concept researches were financed by black funds funneled away from other government projects, so their fixation on dollars and cents always seemed rather anally retentive. Project Cerberus, like all the other totality concept divisions, was classified above top secret. A few high government officials knew it existed, as did members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The secrecy was believed to be more than important. It was considered to be almost a religion. Developing a safe means for the transmission of matter was damnably expensive. Not even Lakesh could argue about that. Nor could he dispute the military's interests in it either. But the Mattrans had less destructive applications as well. Given wide use, the units could eliminate inefficient transportation systems and be used for space exploration and colonizing planets without the time and money-consuming efforts to build spaceships. However, matter transmission was found to be absolutely impossible to achieve by the employment of Einsteinian physics. Only quantum physics, coupled with quantum mechanics, had made it work beyond a couple of prototypes that transported steel balls only a few feet across a room. But even those crude early models couldn't have functioned at all without the basic components that predated the totality concept. As the project's overseer, Lakesh experienced the epiphany and made that crucial breakthrough. Armed with this knowledge, under Lakesh's guidance, the quantum interface mat transinducers opened a rift in the hyperdimensional quantum stream, reduced organic and inorganic material to digital information, and transmitted it along hyperdimensional pathways on a carrier wave. In 1989, Lakesh himself had been the first successful long-distance matter transfer of a human subject, traveling 100 yards from a prototype gateway chamber to a receiving booth. That initial success was replicated many times, and with the replication came the modifications and improvements of the quantum interface Mattrans inducers, reaching the point where they were manufactured in modular form. Skydog, of course, didn't know anything about the history of Project Cerberus. Therefore, he didn't react either like a soldier or a bookkeeper. But like them, when he entered the redoubt's central control complex, it was obvious the shaman had difficulty grasping the technological wonders arrayed before him. The overhead lights in the long, vault-walled room automatically dimmed at sunset and came back on to full brightness at dawn. They were bright now, causing Skydog to squint at the consoles that ran the length of the walls. Indicator lights flickered, red, green, and amber. Circuits hummed, needles twitched, and monitor screens displayed changing columns of numbers. He looked dispassionately at the computer terminals, glanced disinterestedly at the sheaves of paper scattered about the workstations, and appeared to pay no attention to the status lights and blinking icons showing on various screens. The shaman surveyed the spacious room slowly, as if committing everything to memory. He ignored the hunched form of Auerbach at the EnviroOps station, and the burly man returned the favor. Lakesh didn't bother with introductions. Auerbach was, in many ways, directly but inadvertently responsible for the alliance struck by Skydog's people and the Cerberus personnel. Not that he had acted in the formal role of ambassador. He had been first an interloper, then a captive. Skydog turned his head toward the enclosed mainframe computer system, but didn't ask any questions, so Lakesh didn't bother informing him that the redoubt's control complex contained 5 dedicated and 8 shared subprocessors, all linked in a mainframe system. The advanced model used experimental error-correcting microchips of miniature size, which even reacted to quantum fluctuations. The biochip technology that was employed contained protein molecules sandwiched between microscopic glass and metal circuits. The shaman glanced up at the huge Mercator relief map of the world spanning the far wall. Spots of light glowed in almost every continent, and thin glowing lines networked across the countries, like a web spun by a radioactive spider. For the first time, interest showed in his black eyes.
"What is that?"
"That's a map of the world, a current map, showing most of the geophysical changes since the Holocaust."
What do those lines and lights represent? Cain told you about the gateways, didn't he?
Skydog nodded.
Little rooms that take you to the other little rooms, sometimes all the way across the world.
That's one way of putting it.
He pointed to the map.
The lines show all the locations of all functioning gateway units indexed in the Cerberus Metrans network. If any of the units were in use, the light representing its location would blink.
Ah.
Skydog turned back around, gazing across the complex toward the open door of the ready room.
May I see your little room?
Certainly.
Lakesh led the tall Amerindian through the operation center and into the adjacent room. He gestured to the freestanding 8-foot-tall jump platform.
There you are, the Quantum Interface Matrans Inducer, commonly called a gateway unit.
The 6-sided chamber was enclosed by slabs of brown-tinted armaglass. All of the official Cerberus gateway units in the Matrans network were color-coded, so authorized jumpers could tell at a glance into which redoubt they had materialized. Despite the fact it seemed an inefficient method of differentiating one installation from another, only personnel holding color-coded security clearances were allowed to make use of the system. Inasmuch as their use was restricted to a select few units, it was fairly easy for them to memorize which color designated what redoubt. Armaglass was manufactured in the last decades of the 20th century from a special compound that combined the properties of steel and glass. It was used as walls in the jump chambers to confine quantum energy overspills. Lakesh usually felt a small flush of pride whenever he looked at this particular unit, since it was the first fully debugged matter transfer inducer built after the prototypes. It served as the template for all subsequent units. Skydog approached the unit warily, circling the elevated platform and eyeing his distorted reflection in the armaglass walls.
How does it work?
Cain didn't explain it to you?
The corners of Skydog's mouth twitched as if he were trying to repress a grin.
He tried, but he never got very far. He'd either stop on his own or because my people would start laughing.
Lakesh didn't try to repress his own grin. He was a little comforted that Cain hadn't managed to convince the Amerindians that it was possible to travel instantaneously through invisible pathways. He had often wondered just what Cain talked about when he visited Skydog's people. Most of the people in the redoubt, with the exception of Domi, were vil-bred, and they were accustomed to an artificial environment. Rarely did any of them stray more than 10 yards from the edge of the plateau. Cain, however, would frequently complain of suffering from redoubt fever and borrow one of the vehicles to drive down the treacherous mountain road to the foothills to Skydog's permanent encampment. No one asked what he did down there among the Amerindians, where he was known and admired as Unktomi Shunkaha. It was a name the band of Sioux and Cheyenne had bestowed upon him, first conceived as something of an insult. It became synonymous with cunning and courage after he orchestrated the Indians' victory over a magistrate assault force. After remaining with the band for a few days, Cain would show back up at the redoubt, oftentimes dirty and disheveled, but always relaxed. Lakesh and others wondered if Cain had a willing harem of Indian maidens who always looked forward to a visit from Unktomi Shunkaha, but everyone knew better than to inquire about it.
Well, I don't blame them for laughing. It's very difficult to describe. It sounds like magic, not science.
Skydog tentatively tapped an armaglass slab.
Is this how Unktomi Shunkaha and his friends got to the moon?
Lakesh shook his head.
Similar operating principle, but a different device.
Skydog turned to face him, his expression inscrutable.
And the woman I brought here, she is similar to a human being, but a different device too?
Lakesh was startled into chuckling.
Actually, you are not too far wrong, but she is definitely human, just different.
So I gathered.
The man's grim slash of a mouth tightened.
I respect Unktomi Shunkaha as I respect no other, his Wasikun blood notwithstanding. But I find it hard to believe he would lie with such a creature as her. They're called hybrids, unholy mixtures of human and not human. You make war on them, do you not?
Lakesh inwardly flinched from Skydog's unexpected display of revulsion. He groped for something noncommittal to say.
On those like her, yes. But as Cain is not like all white men, neither are all hybrids the same.
Still, white men are human. Their blood is the same as mine. Whatever our other differences, our roots are the same. When my people black their faces and make war on them, there is honor in it. We kill them and take their hair because they've done something to threaten or offend us. The very fact of the hybrid's existence is threatening and offensive. I assumed you waged war on them to exterminate them, to purge their seed from the earth. Lakesh felt a flush of both shame and anger warming the back of his neck.
Genocide is not our aim. If possible, we want to preserve both sides, reach an accord where we can live in peace with one another, as we here have done with your people.
And the way you do that is to lie with their women, to make more mixtures, hybrids of hybrids? That is not a warrior's path to victory.
Firstly, we have no idea who the father of Quavel's child is, whether one of her own, Cain, or someone else entirely. Secondarily, the path to victory is not always a straight route. You, of all people, should know that.
Skydog lifted a challenging eyebrow.
Will your medical expert be able to find out who has fathered the creature's child?
Lakesh shrugged.
I don't know. Is it really that important to you?
Skydog didn't respond for such a long time. Lakesh wondered if he had heard the question. At length, the shaman answered.
That would depend, Lakesh.
On what?
On how important it is to you.
The treatment room of the infirmary was deserted, all the beds empty. Lakesh detected a stinging whiff of chemicals, the tart smell of sterilizing fluids as he crossed the room. Skydog had decided to walk around the plateau and check on his horses, so Lakesh went to consult with Reba Dufour. Dufour was removing a glass tube containing a ruby-red fluid from the centrifuge when Lakesh strode into the laboratory. She almost dropped the tube when she caught sight of Lakesh out of the corner of her eye. Swiftly, biting back a curse, she returned the tube to the clamp on the centrifuge and cast an angry glance over her shoulder.
I liked it better when you shuffled. Made it harder for you to sneak up on someone.
Lakesh smiled, but due to the fresh memory of Skydog's words, it was forced, perfunctory.
I never sneak. I might creep and skulk, but sneaking is not in my repertoire.
Dufour removed the tube from the centrifuge. She stepped farther down the black ceramic-topped trestle table.
But shuffling might be again.
Lakesh didn't respond to her oblique reference about his physical condition. Both of them had talked the matter to death for the past few months. Even after 5 years, he and Dufour still disagreed on a wide variety of matters. She had accused him of being overly demanding and high-handed, and sometimes he was sure she outright distrusted him, particularly after supplying Balaam with the destination lock codes of the redoubt's gateway. Quite possibly she thought he was lying about the means of restored youth. He couldn't blame her about that, not really. She didn't even pretend to understand how it had happened. The process Lakesh described flew so thoroughly in the face of all her medical training, as limited as it was, he might as well have attributed the cause to an angelic intervention. All Dufour really knew was that a few months ago she watched Mohandas Lakesh Singh step into the gateway chamber as a hunched-over, spindly old man who appeared to be fighting the grave for every hour he remained on the planet. A day later, the gateway chamber activated, and when the door opened, Cain, Brigid Baptiste, Grant, and Domi emerged. A well-built stranger wearing the white bodysuit of Cerberus duty personnel followed them. Lakesh still remembered how Dufour gaped in stunned amazement at the man's thick, glossy black hair, his unlined olive complexion and toothy, excited grin. She recognized only the blue eyes and the long, aquiline nose as belonging to the Lakesh she had known these past 5 years. Lakesh stood quietly, hands clasped behind his back, as Dufour busied herself with the micropipette assembly. She inserted a fluted end through the cap of the test tube and carefully worked it until the glass tip touched the red liquid. He admired the brisk, deft efficiency of the woman's movements, and he silently thanked whatever form of providence had delivered Dufour into the Cerberus redoubt. A stocky, buxom woman in her early 30s, Dufour always wore her ash-blonde hair pulled back from her face, intricately braided at the back of her head. Its color contrasted starkly with the deep bronze of her skin and her dark brown eyes.
She always looked good in the one-piece white jumpsuit most Cerberus Redoubt personnel wore as duty uniforms. Reba DeFore was one of the few exiles who acted as a specialist. The 10 people who lived in the Cerberus Redoubt, regardless of their skills, acted in the capacity of support personnel. They worked rotating shifts, 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. For the most part, their work was the routine maintenance and monitoring of the installation's environmental systems, the satellite data feed, the security network. However, everyone was given at least a superficial understanding of all the Redoubt systems, so they could pinch hit in times of emergency. Fortunately, such a time had never arrived, but still and all, the installation was woefully understaffed. Their small numbers were a source of constant worry to Lakesh, particularly since he could no longer practice his secret recruitment program, so he felt it was important that everyone have a working knowledge of the Redoubt's inner workings. DeFore had instructed two of the staff, Banks and Auerbach, in medicine, in case she was ever incapacitated or there was a medical crisis. Grant and Kane were exempt from this cross-training, inasmuch as they served as the enforcement arm of Cerberus and undertook far and away the lion's share of the risks. On their downtime between missions, they made sure all the ordnance in the armory was in good condition and occasionally tuned up the vehicles in the depot. Bridget Baptiste, due to her eidetic memory, was the most multifaceted member of the Redoubt's permanent staff, since she could step into any vacancy and perform the required tasks in an exemplary manner. However, her gifts were a two-edged sword, inasmuch as that same set of skills made her an indispensable addition to away missions.
Is that a blood sample from our...
My patient. Actually, this is a sample of the fetus's blood.
DeFore turned on the vacuum pump, and Lakesh watched as a tiny clot of liquid scarlet inched its way up through the pipette to a slide, waiting on the analyzer's feeder tray. She closed it, and her fingers clattered over the attached keyboard as she instructed the machine about which data to obtain and analyze.
But you performed a physical examination of Quavel?
Only as much as she allowed. Like she said, she's in perfect health, or appears to be. But I don't have much of a frame of reference for hybrids, you know. I've never seen one before, remember?
And her child?
The fetal heartbeat was 160 beats per minute, which is normal.
Lakesh watched as DeFore initiated the karyotype charting and the statistical analysis of the recombinant mitochondrial DNA. The computer hummed purposefully.
How far along is Quavel?
DeFore turned toward him, resting an ample hip against the trestle table.
That's hard to tell, since she didn't permit an in-utero examination. I don't know about the enlargement of the womb. I was able to take blood and urine samples. From those, I'd guess she's about to enter her third trimester.
What about the sex of the child?
DeFore shook her head.
She wouldn't allow a sonogram either. Told me it was unnecessary.
A rueful smile creased her full lips.
You've brought me some of the strangest patients over the past couple of years. A mind-controlled Mongolian warrior, a Martian transadapt, not to mention the time I took an EEG of Kane and got back 3 grafts.
This time I didn't bring you a patient. She came on her own. What about paternity?
What about it?
From her blood sample, would you be able to identify the father of her child?
DeFore frowned.
Only if I had another blood sample available to compare it to and make a match. Do you have someone in mind?
Before he could answer, the computer chimed and printed out a long strip of paper. DeFore ripped it along the perforation and began to study the sequence of black squiggles imprinted along its length. After a moment, she glanced uneasily over at Lakesh. He stepped closer, recognizing the symbols on the paper strip as DNA strands.
Is there a problem?
She shook her head.
I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's...
Her words trailed off and she narrowed her eyes. She began speaking again.
Normally, a gene sequence on a strand of DNA acts like a fingerprint for a given ethnic group. This specimen defies every pattern I'm familiar with, and those the computer is programmed to recognize.
She used one of her fingernails to trace the sequence, and even to Lakesh's unpracticed eye, it appeared somehow fragmented. Lakesh felt a sinking sensation in his belly.
Does that indicate a birth defect of some kind?
I don't know what it indicates. I need to do a full range of tests and analysis, and that'll take time. And it'll require Quavell's complete cooperation.
Folding the printout, DeFore gazed directly into his face.
And frankly, I don't know if keeping her here for that period of time is such a sound strategy.
She's an exceptionally useful font of information about the current state of the baronies and how they're reacting under the reign of the Imperator.
That information conduit works both ways. For example, how did a hybrid know how to find us?
Locke shrugged.
Presumably, she learned of our location from either Domi or Kane during their captivity in Area 51.
Presumably. And presumably, if she knows, so do other hybrids. And if other hybrids know, so do the Barons.
Lakesh scowled at her tone.
Supposition. Both Domi and Kane described Quavell as the de facto leader of a fifth column within Area 51, an anti-Baron brigade, so to speak.
That's what they were told. Maybe that's what they believe. But I don't think the rest of us here can afford the same luxury.
Lakesh angled a challenging eyebrow at her.
Just what are you implying? That she's a spy? A Trojan horse? Setting the stage for an invasion force to come battering at our door?
It's happened before. Except the last time they didn't need to batter at our door, since you opened it for the Imperator and his mother. What was her name again? Erica something or other?
Erica Van Sloan.
I think there might be a connection between Quavell, Sam, and Erica something or another.
That's quite a stretch.
DeFore's eyes turned cold.
You're the one who always claims there are no such things as coincidences, remember?
Synchronicity isn't the same thing as a conspiracy.
DeFore turned her back on him.
They aren't mutually exclusive either, Lakesh.
If it makes you feel better, I have every intention of thoroughly questioning Quavell. Do you know where she is?
DeFore waved a negligent hand.
Domi has taken her under her wing. She was with her in here during the examination. You might want to try the cafeteria, since Quavell said she was hungry.
Lakesh nodded, realized DeFore wasn't looking at him, and annoyed, he turned sharply to leave the laboratory. A sudden pain stabbed through his right knee. The pain was brief, but it was familiar, and he fought to prevent a cry from escaping his lips. Arthritis pains had become more and more frequent of late, particularly when he made swift moves. He had come to accept that Sam's magical laying on of hands definitely had its limits, but the prospect of aging 30 years in 30 days didn't appeal to him. As Lakesh walked swiftly through the infirmary and out into the corridor, he felt a cold dread spreading through him. The concept that Sam and Quavell were somehow in league seemed ridiculous on the face of it, but he couldn't afford to discard the possibility out of hand. Although they had Quavell to provide valuable and perhaps even critical intelligence about the baronies, he couldn't shake the suspicion that she had them, too, perhaps right where she wanted them. The tunnel became little more than a curving ledge with a rock wall on one side and yawning, impenetrable blackness on the other. It led upward, and the 7 people inched their way along it, flattening themselves against the wall. Finally, the ledge stopped slanting upward, widened, and leveled out. They made their way through a short passageway. Grant noted how the composition of the tunnel walls and floor suddenly changed when they entered it. Both walls bore deep horizontal grooves, and the stone floor was a series of concrete slabs. Having seen similar grooves in the walls of the Manetius base, he recalled how Bridget had opined they were marks caused by tunneling lasers. The passageway opened into a bowl-shaped cave. Illuminated by the weird blue glow of the light panels, the cavern spread out before them in a fantastic and eerie panorama. Gigantic stalactites hung from the arched roof like stone spearheads. The cavern's floor rose to meet them in glassy ridges formed by alternate heating and cooling. Grant didn't question Saladin or the other men about their destination. They didn't speak to him or bother to bind him. At first, he thought it was due to inexperience on their part, then grudgingly realized they simply didn't think he was worth the effort. There was no place for him to go, unarmed and without an EVA suit. As it was, he found himself wheezing, laboring to fill his lungs with the rarefied air. No one else seemed to be experiencing any respiratory difficulties, so he knew if he tried to make a break for it, his captors would probably just wait until the exertion caused him to pass out and then retrieve him. Saladin put Majira in his charge, and he marched along with a hand on her bony shoulder, guiding her away from collisions with boulders and preventing her falling into fissures in the floor. Grant found himself feeling sorry for her. Old, half-crippled, and blind, she reminded him of dregs he had encountered during his mag years. Saladin led the group through the rocky labyrinth, never pausing or hesitating to collect his bearings. Here and there, amid the stone forest, pits of fire glowed, and occasionally he saw a jet of yellow flame that burst up from a volcanic pocket burning far below. They were relics of the moon's dead youth, and responsible for the thin oxygen. Saladin sure-footedly wended his way through a maze of stalagmites. Many of them had been exposed to extreme heat in the dim past and were vitrified. Ghostly glows from the fire pits painted their glassine surfaces with flickering rainbow colors. Grant saw stacks of pipes and signs of excavation. Apparently, the original colonists had attempted to harness the thermal energies for heat and power. The group of people followed Saladin through the mineral maze to the edge of a 20-foot-wide drainage channel cutting through the floor. Through it flowed a sluggish stream of dark, algae-filmed water that exuded the same open cesspit stench as the peat bog he had crawled through. The atmosphere around it was thick, clammy, and fetid. Grant noted how the current flowed into a wide-mouthed pipe protruding from the cavern wall. A limestone arch spanned the stream, and they trooped into it. The incline wasn't steep, but the natural bridge was so narrow the little party had to walk along it single file. Grant and Majira brought up the rear. As they navigated it, Saladin suddenly came to a halt at the midway point, gesturing sharply behind him. His men immediately stopped. No one questioned him or even appeared to breathe. They stood stock still as if frozen. Grant, towering nearly a full head over everyone else, peered at the far side of the bridge. He saw only blue-lit shadows, and he shifted his feet impatiently. Then he glimpsed a blur of movement, a pair of vague gray outlines. His skin prickled, and he unconsciously held his breath as the shapes slunk closer. The dark gray, streamlined figures of Carnobots scuttled close to the bank of the channel. The machines were roughly triangular in configuration. A smooth front rose to an almost comically tiny head set at the apex of the triangle. The back was a long slope that tapered to the ground. Their four legs moved swiftly beneath them, positioned almost as kickstands might be beneath motorcycles. Two tiny red eyes gleamed above a square snout and a mouth full of needle-tipped alloyed teeth. The Carnobots paused for a moment, their heads rising at the ends of segmented metal necks, turning this way and that as if trying to catch a scent. Grant tensed, then realized their odor sensors were probably overwhelmed by the stink of the stream. Their photoreceptors detected movement and body heat, and with everyone wearing thermal-baffling outfits and standing still, the robots couldn't react to either signature. The Carnobots lowered their heads and moved on. Grant recalled how Filboid claimed the deadly mechanisms had been manufactured back before the Holocaust and field-tested on the moon. Sometime during his and his companion's long period in stasis, their programming was altered. Saladin waited until the Carnobots were out of sight before moving again. He strode to the end of the arch and walked forward. Beyond the foot of the bridge, the cavern floor rose in a wall. In it was hacked a shallow flight of steps leading to a metal-sheathed door set between a square frame of dark iron. Saladin quickly bounded up the steps to the door. Grant couldn't tell how he opened it since he saw no handle or knob, but slowly the portal began to swing inward, hinges squeaking. There seemed to be nothing beyond but dark. Then lights began to glow. The opening of the doors activated a lighting system. In swift succession, overhead neon tubes flickered to life and cast a steady yellow illumination. Saladin and his men stepped over the threshold. A long hexagonal shaft yawned away before them, the sharply angled walls glassy and gray. It was so long, the nether end was lost in the distance. Guiding Majira with one hand, Grant walked into the passageway, his expression not registering his surge of astonishment. Inlaid in the walls, behind glass panels, stretched maddeningly intricate ribbons and patterns of circuitry. Tiny lights flashed and blinked intermittently but synchronously. The air was fresh and without the cesspit taint. Saladin and his men took long-legged, purposeful strides. Grant followed, but he didn't try to catch up. He studied the network of circuitry as he passed, trying to reason out its purpose. The glass panes threw back his distorted reflection, transforming his dark, mustached face into an elongated smear. The passageway became a catwalk, stretching across a huge chamber like a cavern made of steel. The walls, ceiling, and floor of the chamber formed one continuous surface, making a huge, hollow ellipse, measuring at least 100 feet on the longer diameter. Grant glanced over the handrail, slowed his pace, then came to a stop, pulling Majira to a halt. Resting far below in a hangar were 6-winged aircraft, identical to the one he had glimpsed earlier driving off the Tav. He saw now the resemblance to Earth's manta rays was more than superficial, particularly with the ribbed, curving wings at full extension. The vehicles had 15-yard-long fuselages, 20-yard wingspans with 5-yard tails tipped by spade-shaped rudders. Although they appeared to be made of a burnished bronze alloy, Grant doubted that was the actual composition. Covering almost the entire surface were intricate geometric designs, deeply inscribed into the metal itself. They were interlocking, swirling glyphs, the cup and spiral symbols he had seen before, and even the elaborate Sumerian cuneiform markings. The cockpits were almost invisible, little more than elongated symmetrical oval humps in the exact center of the sleek topside fuselages. Now he could see that features of the craft he had at first thought crude were only different, alien. He recalled the Aurora stealth plane he had shot down months before in New Mexico and recognized a similarity in configuration and design. He knew it wasn't a coincidence, just as he knew that the Manta ships had served as the template for both the Aurora and the Tavs. One of Saladin's men looked over his shoulder and gestured sharply with the barrel of his plasma rifle, an unmistakable order for Grant to come along. Reluctantly, Grant stopped his visual examination of the aircraft and joined the others, guiding Majira ahead of him. The catwalk led into a circular chamber, the walls curving gracefully up to form a domed, transparent ceiling. A billion stars glittered frostily above it. Waist-high instrument panels encircled the rim of the dome, all of them blinking, clicking, or both. The chamber was full of people, at least a dozen men and women, some wearing zippered coveralls, others clad in an assortment of olive-green military fatigues, and others in EVA suits. All of them wielded just as varied an assortment of weapons, from old AK-47s to bolt-action rifles with scopes and almost everything else in between. Grant felt the tension in the air, as palpable as static electricity before a lightning storm. He had participated in enough councils of war to recognize one without having to be told what was going on. The people milled about, clustering around someone or something in the center of the chamber. The few who noted his and Majira's entrance did so by eyeing them briefly with a mixture of hostility and curiosity, then turning away. Grant and the old woman halted at the outer fringe of the ring of people. He wondered if he should draw attention to himself by demanding answers to the multitude of questions swirling through his mind, or if he should continue to be silent and unobtrusive, waiting for a chance to escape. Before he could make up his mind, Saladin's sharp voice rang out,
"Outlander, get your ass up here!"
Leaving Majira, Grant shouldered his way through the throng, not allowing the surge of anger he felt at Saladin's autocratic tone to show on his face. Later he would express his displeasure. When he reached the center of the chamber, he came to a sudden halt, his breath seizing momentarily in his lungs. Cain and Bridget Baptiste stood in the center of the ring of people. Like him, they had been stripped of their EVA suits. A smile of relief crossed Bridget's face.
Thank God.
Cain, on the other hand, seemed engrossed in conversation with someone and casually glanced his way, acknowledging his presence with a short nod.
Oh, there you are.
Grant opened his mouth to voice a loud and profane rebuke. He closed his mouth almost instantly when he saw the man with the pointed ears. The man looked him up and down with eyes that might have been cut from azure crystals.
My name is McCann. I'm told your name is Grant. Well, Grant, allow me to welcome you to the Devil's Playground.
Neither Cain nor Bridget blamed Grant for simply standing and staring at McCann. Although his expression was as immobile as if it had been carved from teak, Kane knew the big man was struck dumb with astonishment. He understood his reaction completely. It was one thing to discuss the concept of an alien race that had once inhabited the solar system, even to see and touch their artifacts. But to come face to face with the living, breathing reality was more than startling. It was shocking, mind-numbing, probably as close to madness as Grant was ever likely to get. Brigid stepped close to him, moving slowly so as not to attract unwelcome attention from either McCann or the armed people.
He's one of the Tuatha De Danann, I think. He looks strange, but he's closer to humanity in appearance than Balaam, and you got used to him.
McCann's mobile mouth twisted as if he tasted something exceptionally sour.
Balaam.
Instantly, his crystal blue eyes darkened as if India ink had been poured into pools of clear water.
I remember him. He led the attack on our colony on Lamu.
Kane caught Brigid's eye.
Lamu?
Mars.
Kane nodded once in understanding. During the briefing before the phase transit to the moon, Brigid had mentioned the possibility that the Tuatha De Danann and the Anunnaki may have been age-old rivals competing with each other for the natural resources of the different planets in the solar system. After the pact, the Danann established at least an outpost on Mars and were driven from it in the relatively recent past. He recollected how, upon their first encounter with Sindri, he told them that beginning in the 1860s and going to the 1870s, astronomers on Earth reported monstrous explosions occurring on Mars, visible even with the primitive telescopes of the day. The phenomenon ended abruptly in 1872. Sindri theorized the astronomers were witnessing aerial bombardments and missile attacks. Grant visibly pulled himself together, giving Kane the impression of a man waking from a bad dream, but not finding his waking reality any more pleasant. Taking a very long, very deep breath, he gazed directly at McCann.
Are we prisoners or what?
At this point, you're what?
Kane surreptitiously studied the dark man. He was obviously hard-bitten, but he exuded the quality of a military man.
I don't believe we've had the pleasure. McCann told us your name, but little beyond that.
His black eyes fixed on her intently.
That's because there is very little to tell. My people and I are in his service.
In his service for what?
McCann turned toward him, his eyes slowly changing color, lightening to a pewter gray. The effect was chilling, and Kane felt a quiver of xenophobia the likes of which he hadn't experienced since the first day he had met Balaam.
You have a rather intrusive tongue, Kane. You remind me of a human warrior who meddled in the affairs of the Danann on Ogier. I found his arrogance intolerable.
Kane didn't respond, remembering that Ogier was an ancient synonym for Ireland. He had met several people there who claimed Danann ancestry. One of whom, Fand, believed him to be the reincarnation of the great Celtic warlord Cuchulain. A diminutive of Cuchulain was Cain, but this didn't seem to be the appropriate time to point out the connection to McCann. McCann's steady gaze didn't falter, but the color of his eyes continued to lighten. Cain hoped that meant he was calming down.
Your life and those of your companions is mine. And to keep it, you need to know when to listen and when to ask questions. Bring the old witch bitch forward.
The people shifted position, murmuring. Then Majira was rudely thrust into the center of the room. Kane and Brigid winced when they saw her. McCann, however, uttered his peculiar sobbing laugh.
Whatever happened to you, my lady?
He mimicked a courtly bow, even though she could not see it. His gesture elicited a ripple of appreciative laughter from the onlookers. Grant didn't expect her to reply, but she did with a surprising degree of dignity.
I bear my wounds proudly, demon. They were incurred in service to my god.
McCann stepped closer to her, thrusting his lower lip out petulantly.
Now, you see, I don't understand that. I never understood it. Why would you worship that ancient bag of scales as a god, but vilify me as a demon? I mean, your kind invaded our tombs, revived us both at the same time, stole my instruments and devices, and yet you decided I was a demon and he was a god.
He turned toward the assembled people, gesturing grandly as if beseeching them to make clear a murky point.
Is there anyone on this thrice-damned rock who resembles a demon?
He received more laughter from the people, but Majira seemed serenely unaware of it. She spoke, but her words were unintelligible. McCann waved everyone to silence.
What did you say?
Your kind arrived later. You deceived humanity on Earth, just as you deceived us here. You gave us weapons, but they destroyed only our faith in you, not our enemies. You promised us power, but you have no power.
McCann nodded in agreement.
I have nothing. The day of my kind has passed. Neither I nor your god have anything to offer you. All here is dead, worn out, corroded, crumbled, useless. But Enki wishes the end of everything.
An ending that will be a new beginning.
McCann laughed sibilantly. It was not the sobbing titter they had heard before, but more like noxious gas leaking from a faulty valve.
I know. Your motives are pure. The mysteries of humankind's origins must be preserved, and you believe you are the guardians of those mysteries. But that makes you and your followers no less fools. Thrice, four times fools. You violated the most fundamental element of a priesthood, Majira. You began to believe in your own lies. You managed the religion and reaped the benefits. You made the rules and played the game according to them. But you forgot you are only mortal. You can be killed and tortured and mutilated, just like you have done to all the sinners.
I served my god.
You served only a delusion created by a crazed ancestor of yours, Majira. And do you think Enki is unaware of this? He knows, just as I do, he only used you to achieve his own ends.
His own ends that will result in a new beginning. That is what you fear.
McCann stroked his chin musingly.
Perhaps you are right. I do not want a new beginning for either Enki or myself. We've had our time, our reign, our worshippers. But the life of humankind is not the life of either the Anunnaki or the Danann. Nor is human death our death. We ceded our power of life and death to the first folk, the spawn of our combined seed. But Los, Urizen, Lam, all of them squandered that inheritance.
Cain repressed a shiver. Despite McCann's contemplative tone, his eyes were changing again, red glints swimming in them, slowly filling the gray irises.
As you have squandered your life in service to Enki.
Majira drew herself up regally.
My life has had purpose. We have levied judgment on the sinners of two worlds. None of my ancestors, those who carried my name and title, can boast of that.
If such a small accomplishment gives you comfort now, as you stand on the brink of death, then I shall not attempt to disaccommodate you of it.
He turned to Saladin.
Have you a knife? Preferably one that has been sharpened in the last century?
Saladin bent, unzipped the seal of his boot, and withdrew a long combat knife. Grant recognized it as his own. He had dropped it in the chasm, but he didn't think Saladin or McCann would appreciate his raising an issue of ownership. Saladin presented it to him hilt first. McCann examined the 14-inch long tungsten steel knife, thumbing the blued, double-edged blade.
Exquisite manufacture.
He stepped very close to Majira.
Your term of service to your god is over. However, you may be able to provide a small boon to your demon.
McCann planted the heel of his free hand against Majira's chin and slowly forced her head back until her blind eyes gazed up at the domed roof arching overhead. Then he pressed the point of the blade against her throat. Uttering a wordless cry of horror and anger, Brigid lunged forward, reaching for McCann. Saladin grabbed her by the left arm, and Brigid's swift, left-legged snap kick caught him in the midsection, driving the air from his lungs. As he bent in the middle, Brigid shifted her balance and delivered a roundhouse kick from the right. The weighted sole of her boot caught the man in the temple, slamming him, dazed, to the floor. Her movements were so quick, so practiced and economical, both Cain and Grant were taken completely by surprise. Brigid continued her forward rush, but without even looking at her, McCann shot out his left arm, and his hand closed around her throat. Kane and Grant made attempts at lunges of their own, but strong arms restrained them, and the barrels of a variety of weapons were trained on them. They could only watch in helpless frustration as Bridget tried to pry McCann's inhumanly long fingers from her neck. McCann's grip tightened, ropey muscles rippling along his arm. He swung her up and off her feet as if she weighed no more than a straw-filled dummy. He held her suspended there while Bridget clutched at his wrist and gagged for air, feet kicking for the floor.
Do not presume bearing the name of one of my own kind makes me predisposed to look on you with favor.
His eyes gleamed like drops of fresh blood.
Your life is mine. If I give it back to you, it's because you can be of service to me, not because of my merciful nature.
He opened his hand and Bridget fell to the floor, crouching there on her hands and knees, taking in great, shuddery gasps of air. She clutched at her throat, face contorted in pain. Kane gazed at her, trying to tamp down the seething rage building in him. He lifted his eyes toward McCann, and the rage boiled over into hatred. The men holding him felt him tense, and they clamped down tighter, immobilizing him. The bore of a steel pellet pistol pressed against the side of his head, and he forced himself to relax in his captor's grips. Survival first, he reminded himself grimly, then revenge. After Bridget had begun breathing more or less normally again, she was dragged to her feet, her arms wrenched behind her in hammerlocks. McCann watched, his mouth twisting in a smirk. Then he returned his attention to Majira and swiftly slashed her throat open from ear to ear. The old woman made no outcry or effort to struggle. McCann didn't even try to avoid the blood that gushed forth. He was drenched in the liquid vermilion, but he thrust the tip of the knife into the incision he had made in Majira's throat and separated two of the cervical vertebrae. Then he sawed vigorously at the flesh, tendon, and muscle that held the old woman's head to her body. He clutched a handful of her hair, and when her body fell limply to the floor, he held her head in one hand. He raised it high for all to see. The people in the room roared and howled in approval, shaking their weapons over their heads, stamping their feet, splashing blood in speckled patterns in all directions. McCann stepped over to Bridget and dangled Majira's head before her.
You will take this back to the Citadel. To any you meet, you will say, McCann gives you a last gift and a final message. It is time to pay the devil his due.
Bridget made no reply, but her eyes flashed with emerald sparks of loathing. Kane glanced over at Grant.
Time to go.
Lakesh was in the mood for a briefing, but he didn't go to the officially designated briefing theater on the third level. Big and blue-walled, it was equipped with 10 rows of theater-type chairs facing a raised speaking dais and a rear projection screen. It was built to accommodate the majority of the installation's personnel, back before the nuke cost, when military and scientific advisors visited. Now, because the briefings rarely involved more than a handful of people, they were almost always convened in the more intimate dining hall. When Lakesh entered the cafeteria, he saw Domi seated at a table near the serving station. Quavel stood nearby, examining the food in the trays. Farrell and Bry, two more Cerberus personnel, sat on the far side of the room dawdling over their breakfast, and they nodded to him as he came in. Farrell was a rangy, middle-aged man who affected a shaved head, a goatee, and a gold hoop earring after watching an old pre-dark vid called Hell's Angels on Wheels. Bry, who served as Lakesh's technical lieutenant, had short, curly copper hair and was a round-shouldered man of small stature. His expression was always one of consternation, no matter his true mood. Both men were studies in physical contrasts, but they now shared a similar manner. They surreptitiously eyed Quavel with a mixture of suspicion and fascination. Lakesh stopped at their table on his way to the coffee maker.
"Has Domi introduced you to our guest?"
Bry nodded. Farrell responded in the affirmative and let the matter rest. The two men showed no inclination to continue the conversation, so Lakesh poured himself a cup of coffee and joined Domi at her table. One of the few advantages of being an exile in Cerberus was unrestricted access to genuine coffee, not the bitter synthetic gruel that had become the common subpar substitutes in Skydark, the generation-long nuclear winter. Literally tons of freeze-dried packets of the real article were cached in the redoubt's storage areas. There was enough coffee to last the exiles several lifetimes. While Quavel daintily sampled the food at the serving station, Lakesh turned to Domi.
"Has she found anything to her liking?"
Domi nodded.
Oatmeal and ice cream.
Never heard of that combination.
She needs food that's easily digestible to her simplified intestinal tract.
Lakesh nodded, assuming Domi was only repeating what Quavel had said. He blew on his coffee to cool it and sipped slowly, using the process to give himself time to properly phrase the multitude of questions he intended to ask. Domi didn't wait for him.
I know what you want to ask. I'm pretty sure the answer is yes.
Lakesh smiled ruefully.
Pretty sure? She didn't tell you?
She shook her bone-white head.
No need.
Then how do you know?
Her eyes. They change whenever his name is mentioned. A man wouldn't know, but another woman can tell.
Lakesh frowned.
Are you sure we are talking about the same thing?
Domi returned his frown.
What did you want to know about?
First and foremost, how she managed to get out of Area 51 without being pursued and apprehended.
Quavel returned to the table, bearing a tray laden with a plate of oatmeal that had two scoops of ice cream swimming in it. As she placed the tray on the table, Lakesh rose and pulled the chair out for her. Quavel acknowledged the gallantry with a gracious nod. Lakesh found himself studying the way her swollen belly was adequately covered and supported by the fabric of her one-piece garment. Absently, he guessed the material was a synthetic polymer with a high degree of elasticity, so one size would indeed fit all. When he caught himself thinking about her clothes rather than the more important issues, he sat back down and swallowed a mouthful of coffee to wash down his own frivolity of thought.
This is not the type of food I'm accustomed to, but it is as close an approximation to the microorganisms I normally ingest as I'm likely to find.
Microorganisms?
They consist primarily of single-cell proteins. They have very little taste.
Lakesh didn't know how to reply to her statement.
That's a shame.
Quavel regarded him curiously with her huge blue eyes, then spooned up ice cream and oatmeal and swallowed it.
You have many questions for me, Mohandas Lakesh Singh.
That I do, madam.
Quavel's eyes flicked swiftly sideways toward Farrell and Bry, who were straining to overhear the conversation but trying not to be too obvious about it. Lakesh cleared his throat and made an elaborate show of peeling back the cuff of his sleeve to consult his wrist chron.
It's 0720. Shift change began some time ago. I'm sure Auerbach would prefer to be relieved from his post. Unless you made a prior agreement with him about extending his shift while you two loitered in here.
Farrell and Bry didn't reply, but they rose stiffly from the table and strode out without a backward glance. They left their cups, plates, wadded-up napkins, and food-encrusted eating utensils on the table. It was a breach of protocol, but Lakesh didn't call them back. It was a small enough protest against authority to overlook. However, it wasn't as if he were the primary authority figure in the redoubt. The mini-coup d'etat staged by Kane, Bridget, and Grant nearly a year before had seen to that. Lakesh hadn't been totally unseated from his position of authority, but he was now answerable to a more democratic process. At first, he bitterly resented what he construed as the usurping of his power by ingrates, but over the past few months, he had felt the burden of responsibility ease from his shoulders. Now, he felt almost grateful. Almost, but not quite, because he had been coerced into sharing his command. Almost every exile in the redoubt had arrived as a convicted criminal, after Lakesh had set them up, framing them for crimes against their respective wills. He admitted it was a cruel, heartless plan with a barely acceptable risk factor, but it was the only way to spirit them out of their vills, turn them against the barons, and make them feel indebted to him. This bit of explosive and potentially fatal knowledge had not been shared with most of the exiles. Grant had grimly predicted that the others would lynch him if they learned of it. When Bry and Farrell were gone and definitely out of earshot, Lakesh turned back to Quavel.
I do indeed have questions, madam.
He employed that particular form of address rather than young lady, because at her age, despite her appearance, he would have felt rather foolish.
They have gone unanswered for some months now, and it's past time they were resolved.
Quavel nodded, and a ghost of a smile played over the high planes of her face. Not for the first time, Lakesh was struck by the delicate, almost elfin beauty of the hybrid race. All in all, they were a beautiful folk, almost too perfect to be real. Their builds were small, slender, and gracile.
All of their faces had sharp planes, with finely complexioned skin stretched tight over prominent shelves of cheekbones. The craniums were very high and smooth, the ears small and set low on the head. Their backslanting eyes were large, shadowed by sweeping supraorbital ridges. Only hair, eye color, and slight variations in height differentiated them. Even their expressions were markedly similar. A vast pride, a diffident superiority, authority, and even ruthlessness. They were the avatars of the new humans who would inherit the Earth, or so they believed. But just like the caste system in place in the Vills, the hybrids observed a similar one. If the first phase of human evolution produced a package of adaptations for a particular and distinct way of life, the second phase was an effort to control that way of life by controlling the environment. The focus switched to a cultural evolution from a physical evolution. The hybrids, at least by their way of thinking, represented the final phase of human evolution. They created wholesale planned alterations in living organisms and were empowered to control not only their environment, but also the evolution of other species. And at the pinnacle of that evolutionary achievement were the Barons, as high above ordinary hybrids bred as servants, like Quavel, as the hybrids were above mere humans. What made the Barons so superior had nothing to do with their physical attributes. The brains of the Barons could absorb and process information with exceptional speed, and their cognitive abilities were little short of supernatural. Almost from the moment the Barons emerged from the incubation chambers, they possessed IQs so far beyond the range of standard tests as to render them meaningless. They mastered language in a matter of weeks, speaking in whole sentences. All of nature's design flaws in the human brain were corrected, modified, and improved, specifically the hypothalamus, which regulated the complex biochemical systems of the body. They could control all autonomic functions of their brains and bodies, even to the manufacture and release of chemicals and hormones. They could speed or slow their heartbeats, increase and decrease the amount of adrenaline in their bloodstreams. They possessed complete control over that mysterious portion of the brain known as the limbic system, a portion that pre-dark scientists had always known possessed great reserves of electromagnetic power and strength. Although they were bred for brilliance, all Barons had emotional limitations placed upon their enormous intellects. They were captives of their shared Archon hive mind heritage, captives of a remorseless mindset that didn't carry with it the simple comprehension of the importance to humans of individual liberty. Smug in their hybrid arrogance, the baronial oligarchy didn't understand the primal beast buried inside the human psyche, the beast that always gave humans a fair chance of winning in the deadly game of survival of the fittest. Visceral emotions didn't play a large part in the psychologies of the so-called new humans. Even their bursts of passion were of the most rudimentary kind, so complex human emotions like loyalty, self-sacrifice, and anger were complete mysteries to them.
Domi has informed me that neither she nor Cain ever provided you with the entire story of their captivity in the Area 51 installation. I gather Cain was too ashamed to relate the details, and Domi respected his reticence.
That pretty much encapsulates it, yes.
Quavel propped her elbows on the edge of the table and steepled her fingers beneath her chin.
When Baron Cobalt captured Cain there, he exacted what he considered a due and just revenge for his part in the destruction of the Dulsa installation.
Lakesh didn't respond. Despite her neutral tone, he detected a hint of anger when she referred to the incident. Her anger was understandable, since the destruction of the installation was a flashpoint, a major cornerstone in the covert war against the baronial oligarchy, an unintentional victory with wide-ranging repercussions. Not even Lakesh could argue that the hybrid race was as intellectually superior to humankind as the Cro-Magnon was to the Neanderthal, but they paid a heavy price for their superior abilities. Physically, they were fragile, their autoimmune systems at the mercy of infections and diseases that had little effect on the primitive humans they ruled. Nor could they reproduce by intercourse. The nine Barons were the products of in vitro fertilization, as were all their offspring. Therefore, the Barons were forced to live insulated, isolated existences, cloaking themselves in theatrical trappings that not only added to their semi-divine mystique, but also protected them from contamination, both psychological and physical. Once a year, the oligarchy traveled to an installation beneath the Archuleta Mesa in Dulsa, New Mexico, for medical treatments. They visited the installation to receive fresh transfusions of blood and a regimen of biochemical genetic therapy designed to strengthen their autoimmune systems, which granted them another year of life and power.